cutting through an overload of information to get to the heart of the story. This is The Point.
Who have planted the roots of all the troubles we're seeing in the South China Sea? The United States, the UK and France came out to point finger at China after a few recent run-ins between Chinese and Filipino vessels near the Rengaijiao, or Second Thomas Shoal in English. But can they really defend their argument? What have their governments been saying about the subject in secret and in public since the beginning of the 20th century? One scholar decided to find out. And he spent years to dig through piles of archives in the three countries, and what he found surprised him. He later put his findings in the book called The History and Sovereignty of the South China Sea. What is the book all about? Welcome to a special edition of The Point with me, Liu Xin, coming to you from Peking University in Beijing. I'm here to talk to the author himself. Professor Kati.
Hello, Ms. Liu. Welcome to the Institute of Humanities and Social Sciences Peking University.
Thank you for hosting us.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Good. Yes.
So you've been posted here for how long now?
For 4 months. It's a four-month period until the summer semester, basically, from the end of February until the beginning of July. Mm-hmm. I am showing you now to my office. So it's a splendid office.
Thank you.
In traditional Chinese culture. Mm-hmm.
So this is where you conduct your studies and...
Yeah, in my reading. This is the book, yes.
And this is the book, The History and Sovereignty of South China Sea. How long did it take for you to complete this book?
A very long, laborious process from about 2011 until 2000 and the end of 2018.
What made you want to do the, a book about the history and sovereignty of the South China Sea? And your finding is very much not in line with the mainstream narrative that's out there.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, the international lawyers are simply, in my view, rather superficial people who simply reproduce government communiques. And I have been trying to persuade my colleagues for years that they can go to the national archives, particularly of countries like Britain and France, who are quite open societies, and the national archives then will disclose what these governments really think. But they're not willing to do that for often very silly logistic reasons. You have to travel to the outskirts of Paris and the outskirts of London to get to these archives. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of my colleagues saying to me, well, I have to collect my children from the school at 5 o'clock. I can't possibly go to these archives.
So
it's as trivial as that.
So how many hours did you spend in the...
I couldn't count them. I mean, it's many months over many years, because the archives are open, but they're not made to be consumed. Like a paperback book that you pick up in a railway station bookshop. I mean, it's a laborious process going through many years. I mean, it's 100 to 120 years of materials from the 1870s, the 1890s, right through the 1920s, the 1930s, after the Second World War, through the 50s and 60s. But it does really end in the 1970s. I haven't gone any further than that.
So how many archives and libraries have you gone to? How many countries have you kept track of?
Well, it's really quite three. I have looked in the National Archive in Kew Gardens in London, mm-hmm. which is a very pleasant place to go, mm-hmm. in southwest London, Parkland, and the archive has a beautiful cafeteria. And,
okay. And by now you know it very well.
The staff are extremely helpful. There's a large number of staff who will do everything they can to facilitate you obtaining the documents. And in Paris, it's a little bit more grim. It's in the northeast of the city on the way to Charles de Gaulle Airport. Mm-hmm. There is a special archive of the French Foreign Ministry at Aubervilliers, La Courneuve. It's a metro station. But you can get from the Gare du Nord to the archive in about 20 minutes.
Okay.
And the archive itself then doesn't have the same facilities, but it's very tidily organized. I went to the United States. I went to the State Department archive, as far as it is available, is in Maryland. It's quite remote from Washington. There are logistic difficulties. To study these archives means going to Washington. It means not merely going to Washington, but taking a rickety bus from outside a building in the center of Washington, you have a rocky 1 hour drive wow. to a remote archive in Maryland. And then you have to hope for the best that you will find.
In one sentence, can you summarize your key tenet, your key conclusion?
There is a key tenet for which connects this work with yourselves. The basic issue is that at the moment, Britain and France, as allies, I would say junior allies of the United States, are taking the public stance that the ownership of the South China Sea Islands is a matter about which they are neutral, and that they think all of the claims made by Malaysia, by Philippines, by Vietnam, and by China, these are all equally plausible, and it's up to China to submit the whole matter to either to adjudication. The actual position of the governments of Britain and France in terms of their historical institutional memory is that the islands are all Chinese. So they need to be confronted with the contradiction between their public stance and their own institutional memory.
What about the United States and the Philippines?
Well, the American position until the Second World War was neutral. But after the Second World War, they decided that any expansion of China back into territories conquered by Japan, such as Taiwan, and also Okinawa, and the South China Sea Islands should not be permitted for strategic reasons.
It's not very big. It's a,
it's quite a short.
But a lot of work went in there. Yeah. So this was originally written.
You have John Foster Dulles. I don't know who this person is, but you can read the name.
It's Assistant Secretary for International Security Affairs Gordon Gray.
Gordon Gray.
Right. Yeah, Murphy was the Foreign Secretary, Foreign Secretary. Back then. There's Robert Dennis Murphy.
Looks like a Chicago gangster.
But why is Dulles so important there?
Well, Dulles drafted the San Francisco Treaty, which left open all of the territorial questions, and he did that deliberately.
Wow.
Against the advice of the legal officer of the State Department.
Well, let's talk about that in just a moment in greater details. Yeah.
This person is Aristide Briand, who was the most prominent French foreign minister of the 20th century and the co-author of the Kellogg-Briand Pact outlawing war. And the French regard him as an icon of French contribution to international peace and security. But he deliberately ignored the advice of his lawyers that the Paracel Islands, the Shisha Islands, were Chinese, and he thought that France would claim them on behalf of Vietnam and then just see what happened. So he's he doesn't come out of this very well.
Wow.
And of course the dispute is not just about the Shisha Island, but also it's Nansha Island, but also about the Shisha Island.
Arthur Henderson.
Yeah. He was the British Foreign Secretary in the Labour government from 1929 to 1931. And he was horrified by the fact that the French were seizing the Paracels and the Spratlys, and said that they are just taking advantage of the weakness of China, which is being harassed by the Japanese, and is also a divided society. So the English were quite shocked.
That they could not have the cake, that the French was having it.
No, the English had enough cake with Hong Kong. They had all the cake they needed. The French were really wanted to catch up with the English.
So Tiller?
He was the British ambassador in Paris, who then had to submit his government's concerns to the French government.
We protest. How about?
This is the Bastidon, the most important French judge of international law in the 20th century. He's there being given a Legion of Honor by President de Gaulle. He was the French judge on the World Court from 1945 to the 1960s. And in 1930s, he was the chief legal counsel to the French Foreign Ministry. And he told Aristide Briand that the Paracels were Chinese.
And all of these you found in the archives?
Yeah, this is all in the archive. Oh. And the French, you see, have washed their hands of the whole Southeast Asia dispute, and so they're quite happy to make all the documents available to the Vietnamese. But officially, I think their position is neutral, because that's basically, if they were not to take this position, they would have a lot of pressure from the United States. Wellington Koo is one of the most distinguished Chinese international lawyers of the 20th century. He was instrumental in persuading China not to sign the Treaty of Versailles, handing the Shandong provinces to the Japanese. Yeah. And he was the Chinese minister in Paris when the South China Sea Islands were being seized. And he wrote many long memoranda in French, which I've been able to read and which are in the archive.
Wow.
And the French legal advisor said that these, to cut a long story short, he said these memoranda were correct, and if there was an arbitration, China would win it.
Wow.
So they were basically bluffing. For me, this is history. There's a difference between law and history. A lawyer tries to decide whether facts fit into a legal rule. A historian is simply concerned with an accurate reproduction of the record, and which may well not be convenient in parts. So then this record is exhaustive. The book is actually looks quite small, but it was a lot of work over a long period, you know, because all of it, all of the heart of the book is a reproduction of archives. Yeah, so it's...
Let's go and talk about it in greater details.
Right.
Sitting down. Let's go through this very important piece of history. To really understand what has happened concerning the history and sovereignty of the South China Sea, where do you think we need to start?
The controversy really begins with the French decision to disturb the Chinese ownership of the South China Sea Islands in the early 1930s. That's when it begins, and in 1974, towards the end of the history that I have written, the French ambassador to China wrote this much to the French Prime Minister, that it was the decision of the French in 1931 to 1933 to seize Xisha and Nansha that upset the whole order in the South China Sea.
So basically your conclusion was that China's claim of sovereignty in the South China Sea was reasonable?
I approached this exercise as a historian. My ambition is to excavate and reproduce without comment, that's very important, without comment, the archival record of the discussions between the politicians, political officials, and legal officials in the French and the British foreign ministries over the period of about 100 years. That archival record shows that a consensus emerged among the French and the British international lawyers, independently and professionally working in the two ministries, that the islands were Chinese. And that is actually summarized and put together in a rather accessible and simple document in 1974 by the British, who wrote about a 6-page or maybe 8-page memorandum and submitted it to the British cabinet, which then endorsed it as a record that the islands, the Spratlys as well as the Paracels, were Chinese. The crucial point, which leads up to all the controversy now, is that the Foreign Secretary at the time, James Callaghan, wrote a handwritten note saying, this may be true, but it's not necessary for us to bring it to the attention of the Chinese. And so then it's possible for the British in the 1990s, to state publicly in Parliament that they are completely neutral and agnostic over who owns the South
China Islands. For what reasons exactly did they decided not to make public about it?
I would say that, well, at the present time, it's pressure from the United States. The United States' position has been consistently indifferent to the legal issues. If you go back to the Second World War, it had been agreed between Chiang Kai-shek and Roosevelt that the Chinese would recover territories that had been seized by the Japanese in the 1930s, and that included the Spratly and the Paracels. But by the time that Truman was preparing the San Francisco conference, the pressure in the United States was to exclude China as far as possible from the South and East China Sea, to contain China. And they were indifferent to the legal questions, which they left open.
So basically, in your book, you wrote about a senior legal counsel to the US State Department, Adrian Fisher. He talked about the United States left a big hole in the San Francisco Treaty to exclude the former Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China outside this treaty, and this was illegal. Why did the United States, knowing that it was illegal, still took the steps for not making known its position on the sovereignty of the South China Sea Islands?
Well, in a way, that question would only receive a speculative answer. I think that I would prefer to make clear what Adrian Fisher meant by saying that the whole San Francisco Treaty process was illegal. Now, Adrian Fisher objected that China was a party to the conflict with Japan and that therefore a peace treaty should include China. He also objected even more seriously that the United States was not interested in concluding a genuine peace treaty. It simply wanted to restore Japanese sovereignty in order for Japan to conclude an interminable military base agreement with the United States. And John Foster Dulles was only interested in this question. Now, this is of enormous importance because none of the territorial disputes that arose out of Japanese aggression were resolved by this so-called peace treaty. So East Asia does not have a legal settlement of the conflicts caused by the Japanese Empire. And that is the fundamental reason why the region is so unstable. And it's entirely the responsibility of the American government.
Help us comb through this, the timeline of the conflicts of the so-called controversy over sovereignty in these islands. Chinese fishermen were going to these islands since time immemorial.
Well, it's partially, this is a very human story. The French governments were normally very weak, coalition governments, and the Indochina French administration in Indochina was very bullish and imperialistic. And in fact, Spratly Islands were seized by an enterprising French admiral or captain, and without the consent of the foreign ministry, without the knowledge of the foreign ministry. But the foreign ministry then learned about this from reading British newspapers, and they were embarrassed about it and felt they had to conform to it. Underlying the French concern was the expansion of the Japanese. And they felt that if they didn't take over these islands, China was in a very weak situation, not effectively administering the islands, and the Japanese had to be kept at bay. But even then, when the French did move into the Paracels and the Spratlys, what you call the Shisha and the Nansha, they didn't effectively occupy them. And then the British offered to lease the islands from the French so that they could be effectively occupied. And this circus went on until the Japanese seized the islands
in 1939.
Yeah. And then in 1944, 45, the Americans cleared the Japanese out of the area. And the Americans then were not interested in any of these legal ownership questions. They were simply interested in making sure to not allow the Chinese back. So it's basically a very human story, and it interspersed in the story are the many legal opinions by the French legal officers that Paracels were originally Chinese and that had been recognized to be Chinese. What I think is outrageous is the most distinguished French politician and Foreign Secretary Aristide Briand said that he knew perfectly well that the legal advice was that the island Paracels were Chinese, but for the sake of political convenience, he would make a claim and then just wait and see what happens. So.
How come the Philippines started to make claims, territorial claims, on some of the islands in...
Both the French and the British are categorical that they have no conceivable claim to the islands and that their claims are absurd. And there are two outstanding records there. There's an entire file of the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs, a legal file from 1974 to 79, denouncing the Filipino claims. And with the United States, there are certain comical records of an Assistant Secretary Murphy in the 1950s saying that it is quite obvious that the Filipinos have absolutely no legal claim to any of these islands, but it is in our interest, in any event, to encourage them to make claims in order to keep the Chinese communists at bay. So basically, that's the story. And so you have it summarized in a British minute, archival minute from 1974, a legal minute which was approved by the entire department, by the head of the legal department, and then approved by the cabinet overseas, Defense and Overseas Committee. So it's an official record of the British government. It's difficult for me to see how the British government can now take the stance that it's neutral when its own official highest authority in the country, the cabinet, has made an official minute that the island, the Spratly Islands, the most contested islands, are Chinese.
So basically, it was said in that minute that you mentioned, basically, that they didn't really treat China back then as a complete or full member of... Or do you think he meant it in a... because China was so weak?
Yeah,
you know?
Well, the British view in the 1930s was very strongly expressed that the French behavior towards China was deeply disreputable because they were taking advantage of the fact that there was civil war within China and that China was being also molested in Manchuria by the Japanese. So they said that it was very wrong of the French to be taking advantage of China's misfortunes.
Some people are saying, look, the French basically said these islands, they were called res nullius, or in other words, these were had no sovereignty. Nobody could claim them.
Yeah.
Is that true? Because there were traces of fishermen inhabiting on the or frequenting it annually or having economic activities. What were some of the earlier archives telling you about there?
Well, this is international law is not rocket science, and there is the French argument that the Chinese were not active at a government and administrative level in the Spratlys or Lantcha Islands in the 1920s and 30s. However, they were intensely occupied by Chinese fishermen for large parts of the year. The French not only recognized that, they said that there were no other South China Sea countries that had nationals fishing there. But there is plenty of record in British and American constitutional and international law that the activities of the citizens of the country automatically attached to them the sovereignty of their states. And the British and the Americans also have taken the view from the middle and the late 19th century that where British or French fishermen or businessmen or explorers for minerals go to islands, that the sovereignty of their country follows them.
So let's talk about the United States reaction nowadays, you know, which is very different from the days of the Dulles administration. For instance, on March the 5th, the United States issued this statement saying the United States stands with the Philippines following the PRC's provocative actions against lawful Philippine maritime operations in the South China Sea. How do you look at the change in standpoint view of the United States on this issue?
Well, I don't think there's that big a change. I mean, if we go back to Murphy in the 1950s, and also there are minutes that I reproduced in the book of Kissinger in the early 1970s, it has always been the consistent American policy to keep the to limit and contain China as far as possible without any regard for law. And that was why this has to be seen in the wider context, that it is a decision of the United States to leave all of the legal territorial issues arising out of Japanese aggression unresolved. It is in the interest of the United States that the countries of the East Asia should be quarreling among themselves. And then the United States has always been very careful to say that it supports that it is neutral between the different contestants, but is willing to support any country that finds itself the subject of the use of force or aggression by China. So it's really fixing on the idea that China is a military aggressor that needs to be stopped bullying smaller countries that are largely defenseless. But there's really no point in looking at the US-Filipino history except in the context of the American suppression of Filipino independence in 1900 and the enormous influence America's had in shaping the whole political, economic, and social structure of the Philippines. The Philippines is a colony of the United States. If the Filipinos had had their independence in 1900, it's conceivable that they would have their own state practice with respect to the South China Sea that could have extended from the time that they became independent. Before that, they were Spanish colonies. So really, the whole history of Filipino-American relations has to be treated with a very big question mark, and everything that comes out of that relationship is very problematic. But I must draw the line on the insistence on the United States that strategically China is to be contained. That record is clear, and it's fundamental. It is not part of American academic or intellectual culture to give any place to international law.
Are you going to continue working on the archives or write about it or speak about it?
Yes, I'm going to, at the stage now, to make the archives as public as possible and to bring them to the attention of the French and British governments and French and British international law associations and ask them to explain themselves and take a stand. This is hardly at all read by international law scholars, as far as I'm aware, and hasn't received any public attention.
Thank you so much, Professor Anthony Carty.
Sure.
Thank you.